The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
Welcome to From the Median, where we are concerned with the middle ground, not just to understand both sides of an argument, but also to awaken the consciences of those who are neutral or indifferent to this, the greatest civil rights movement of all times, the pro-life movement. This evening, we continue our Bringing America Back to Life series. Tonight, we will feature a presentation from our 2020 convention. We know that you will be inspired by the ideas, the principles, the experience, and the wisdom of our speakers as they join us to pave the way back to life through prayer, action, voting, and education. It is my pleasure to introduce to you William J. Federer, beloved speaker and best-selling author across the United States, who is also president of Amerisearch, a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. Bill's American Minute radio feature is broadcast daily across the country. His Faith in History television show airs on stations across the nation. His first book of many, America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations, has sold over 500,000 copies. Bill has spoken across the country at events from Mount Rushmore to the Lincoln Memorial to the U.S. Capitol. We are sure you will enjoy this 21st century historian whose work refutes revisionist attempts to obscure America's noble heritage.
Thank you. Well, thank you. It's a tremendous honor for me to be here with you. Well, I write history books, and I think that gives us a perspective that we don't always get. There was a historian, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian on John F. Kennedy's staff, and he gave a quote. The quote is, "History is to the nation what memory is to the individual." So have you ever met an individual who has lost their memory? Maybe they have Alzheimer's. It's sad. They forgot who they are. They forgot who you are. Well, we started to have national Alzheimer's. Here we are, the freest country that planet Earth has ever seen, and we forgot who we are. We forgot how we got here. And as a result, we're letting our freedoms being taken away. So sometimes when we see the big picture, it helps us to recognize who we are. So hopefully I'll be able to do that today. Now, the value of human life. Not all belief systems and government structures value human life equally. One of the books that I did, it's called Who Was the King in America? It's an overview of all of world history. Sort of ambitious. I went back to the beginning of the invention of writing, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. And you know when that was? That was around 3300 BC. And we're around 2000 AD. So that rounds out to about 5,000 or 6,000 years of records. 5,000 or 6,000 years of human beings writing down human records. And you think of it, 6,000 years is not that long. It's only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. So how many of you have met someone who's lived 100 years or close to it, maybe a grandmother? We're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. Well, now that we have 6,000 years of human beings writing down human records, what do the records show? They show the most common form of government is a king. They go by different names, Nimrod, Pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsars. And as the centuries go on, the kingdoms get bigger. Because with military advancements, you can kill more people. Right? Instead of killing with a rock, you kill with a bronze weapon or an iron weapon. And ultimately, the King of England had the biggest empire that planet Earth had ever seen. The sun never set on the British Empire. He was like a globalist. Now, why does this keep happening? Because it's in each of our own selfish human DNA. Goes back to the fall in the garden and Cain killing Abel. And one king taking a kingdom from another king. So St. Augustine called it libido dominandi, the lust to dominate. And so you put some babies in a playpen, one takes the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one is the bully hogging the ball. You put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some people in the woods, one of them is an Indian chief. And you put them in an inner city, and one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is a glorified gang leader. It's a hierarchical system. If you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason, or you're a slave. And so the value of human life is how well you can serve this king. And that is the way it has been for millennium. And so we begin to see the situation in history of slavery. And so there's the Bible stories of Egyptian slavery and then the treating of the unborn and the young. So here the Pharaoh decided, Exodus 1, when you serve as a midwife to see Hebrew women and see them on the birthstool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. Why? Because you're challenging me as a king. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river. The value of their human life was low. And of course, we know the story of Moses, that his mother took an ark and bulrushes, daubed it with slime and pitch, and put the child therein. And so we see that the caring for the unborn is always at odds with the dictator. And so the Israelites were slaves for 400 years. But the Greeks, did you know the Greeks, Athens, that anywhere from 10 to 40% of the people in Athens were slaves? They were not African slaves. They were other Greek peoples that were captured and so forth. But it was this strata of human value to life. In Sparta, they had a whole slave class. It was called helots. The Roman Empire, the situation that they had was a mother would bear a child and lay it at the father's feet. If the father picked the child up, it was allowed to live. If he did not pick it up, the mother would have to leave the child outside exposed to die. And so here, the value of the life was the father choosing it. And there's all these Roman stories of these, you know, sad situations of the mother putting the baby out to expose it and giving it the last goodbyes and so forth. And of course, Rome was started by some abandoned, exposed children. And their legend was that a wolf came by and nursed Romulus and Remus, and they survived. But the exposure of unwanted infants, it's this. You read the early church condemning this, and it's exactly the same messages we're using today to condemn abortion. And so the value of human life back in the Roman Empire was very low. And Julius Caesar conquered in Gaul, which is Central Europe, and he brought captured Slavic peoples into Rome and gave them away as servants, so much so that the word Slav got the connotation of a permanent servant. And of course, today we pronounce the word Slav, slave. And so here, their value of life was they had to serve their masters, and over half of Rome's population was slaves. The Roman Empire, actually, human life was so low that they killed it for entertainment in the Colosseums. And the stories of Nero pointing up into the crowd and everybody backing away from some person, and then the poor person's left alone, and they pass him down, and they dump him into the Colosseum, and then they kill him. And everybody, like, cheers. This mad rush. But it's human life. It's just low value for entertainment. And they had sex trafficking in the Roman Empire, and all their bathhouses with all their immoral sexual activity. Well, excuse me. Another slavery was generational indebtedness spread by the Roman Emperor Diocletian. So in the 3rd and 4th centuries, Rome, their economy was suffering. They were being invaded by a whole lot of illegal immigrants, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths and so forth. And so the people could no longer pay their mortgages on their property. And they were just walking away from them, leaving their property, leaving their debts, and going off to live with the barbarians. And Diocletian said, no more walking away from your debts. You are permanently tied to your land until it's paid off. Well, with inflation and the debt economy getting worse and worse and worse, you were tied to the debt for the rest of your life. And your children were born into the debt, and they had to carry it their whole lives, and their children and their children and their children. It turned into the feudal system. So for 1,000 years in Europe, people were tied to their land. And there was a tax collector that was the local lord who was employed by the king, and he went around and collected the taxes. But you were a slave. You were literally a slave. And so the kings were the ones who ruled, and they ruled by divine right. And they did not believe everyone was equal. They believed they were a little extra special, right? The divine right of kings. And you see this over and over again in history. I give a little talk where I go through how the world transitioned from hunter-gatherers to agriculture. And when people groups would move from hunter-gatherers to agriculture, they would need to know when to plant crops. And so the Bible story of Adam and Eve plucking the fruit off the tree, and then you have Cain was a tiller of the soil, so you went from gathering to agriculture. And whenever they moved to agriculture, they needed to keep track of the seasons, which means they had to keep track of the stars to know when the seasons changed, which means they would build these big immovable structures to observe the stars, Stonehenge, ziggurats, pyramids, Cahokia Mounds. And someone got to climb up that structure, look at the stars, and come down with the secret knowledge from heaven as to when to plant the crops. And this person began to think of themselves as an intermediary between the heavens and the lowly people below, and that turned into the divine right of kings. I'm the divinely appointed one. And so you would have King James of England, who would say, "Kings are God's lieutenants upon earth, sit upon God's throne. The king is the overlord of the whole land, master over every person, having power over the life and death of everyone." So you can begin to see why America's founders wanted to break away from that. The value of human life. In the year 711, you had the Muslim Moors raided into Europe. For those not familiar with the history, Muhammad dies in 632 AD, and his rightly guided caliphs conquer Egypt, which used to be Christian, evangelized by Mark that wrote the gospel. And then the Muslims conquered Syria, which used to be Christian, evangelized by the Apostle Paul. The name Christian was first used in Syria. They conquered Jerusalem, which had been a Byzantine Christian city since Constantine. And there used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th century, and they were all conquered by the Umayyad Muslims. And then in the year 711, 80,000 Muslims invaded Spain on horseback with stirrups and scimitar swords. Europeans were still fighting on foot, so in 10 years they conquered all of Spain, carried away over 1 million into slavery. And just some of the stories, in the year 1189, they raided Lisbon, Portugal, and carried off 3,000 as slaves. In the year 1191, they carried another 3,000 from Silves, Portugal. Matter of fact, there were whole Catholic orders in Europe during the Middle Ages called the Trinitarians and Maruthians, and they would go to churches and collect alms and donations, and then go under a white flag to North Africa to ransom your friend back who was captured from an island or a ship. Did you know that in 846 AD, 11,000 Muslim warriors invaded Rome, Italy, and they trashed the Basilica of St. Peter's, and they trashed the bones of St. Peter and St. Paul. It was after that that Pope Leo decided to build a 39-foot wall around the Vatican, right, because of these Muslim raiders. Anyway, Saladin, he captures Jerusalem. Remember the Third Crusade, Richard the Lionheart? And according to Imad al-Din, approximately 7,000 men and 8,000 women were sold into slavery. Now, it is a religion of peace. It's just their definition of peace is when the whole world submits to the will of Allah. When we say peace, it's different groups getting along. When they say world peace, they mean world Islam. And a moderate Muslim thinks the world's going to submit later, maybe in the distant future. The fundamental one thinks it's going to submit now. So these are these medieval Catholic orders. They would collect alms and donations. If you've ever been to Prague in the Czech Republic, they have this really nice bridge that goes across the river that's been there for 1,000 years and has statues. And one of the statues is the Muslim Saracen with his sword, and then there's a cage, and inside the cage is a prisoner, and then on top of it is one of these Catholic orders that are ransoming money to ransom them. And they enslaved an estimated 180 million Africans. Muhammad was a white Arab. There are hadiths that said he's the white man reclining on the couch and somebody's donkey rubs up against him. And he says, I saw the whiteness of the prophet's thigh. And he owned African slaves. So in Arabic, there's one word for African and slave. It's the same word, abid. So every black person they would see, they would call him slave. And so they had these Muslim slave markets all across Africa. The value of human life was very, very low. In Tangiers, Morocco, Libya, Cairo, Khartoum, Timbuktu, where the canoe meets the caravan, the Niger River, and then the Swahili area, and then the Horn of Africa, and the Tanzania, the Zanzibar coast, Muslim slave trading ports. Even David Livingstone, remember the Scottish missionary to the Congo? Dr. Livingstone, I presume. He writes in his journal about going through a valley and witnessing to the natives and coming back a year later, and they're all ghost villages. The entire valley had been captured and sold into slavery. Another time he stumbles across a line of Africans shackled together, being forced to march hundreds of miles to the coast. And if they walked too slow, they would just get shot or stabbed. And he says you could tell where the trails were by looking for the vultures circling. And he writes in his diary that more important than discovering the source of the Nile River, which he was looking for, he says, if my revelations can end this monster that hangs over Africa of the Arab slave trade. So we see it still goes on today. There's actually more slavery today than at any other time in world history. In Niger, Mauritania, they call it sex trafficking and forced marriages and so forth. But we're talking about the value of human life. And lo and behold, we come across the oceans, and the Spaniards do, and they come to the New World, and there's the Aztecs. The reason, and the Cortez captures and conquers Aztec Mexico, partly because the Aztecs would fight to get captives to later sacrifice on top of their pyramid by ripping their hearts out. They didn't fight to kill. They were fighting to get captives. And when the Spaniards came over, they fought to kill. Of course, they had steel swords and horses. But the neighboring tribes helped the Spanish because they were tired of giving their young people to have their hearts ripped out. But a low value of human life. The Inca Empire, they had a mandatory system of service. Matter of fact, everyone in the Incan Empire was a slave. Everyone was employed by the state, by the government. And the government was headed up by Atahualpa, who claimed to be a delegate of the sun god. So again, pyramid structure to society, and everyone is equal, but their life is determined by the state. And then when Spain conquers the Inca Empire, all they did was get rid of Atahualpa and put in a Spanish person that was in control. All the people were used to obeying. And so now they obeyed these new leaders that had them work in the Potosi silver mines where a whole lot of them died. But again, low value of human life. And then the different Spaniards would divide up the New World and basically take the feudal system from Europe and put it into America, encomienda or repartimiento, which basically said that all the natives living on this area of land are my serfs. And they're going to work and pay taxes and so forth. Now, there was a priest named Bartolome de las Casas, and he spends his entire life lobbying the King of Spain to outlaw the enslavement of Native Americans. And he finally succeeds, and he's considered a great hero of human rights. Unfortunately, some of the greedy people said, well, if we can't enslave the Native Americans, who can we enslave? And someone said, Africa. And so that began the African slave trade, buying them from the Muslim slave markets, the Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch, French, and then English, bringing them to the New World. Now, there's two threads I trace through history, greed and the gospel. Every era that you read, there are people motivated by the gospel. And they're the ones that are digging wells in villages and having medical clinics and taking care of the orphans. Or, you know, the one missionary to India stopped the sati, which was this Hindu practice where if a man dies, his widow was expected to throw herself on the funeral pyre and be burnt up with him. And the Christian missionary stopped that. And then there was another missionary, Gladys Aylward, that went to China. And matter of fact, Ingrid Bergman did a movie, you know, the Sixth Inn of Happiness or whatever. But that missionary stopped the feet binding of the little girls. Right? They would bind these little feet, and the girl would grow up, but her feet would stay tiny. So you had Christians doing these good works. So you have two threads through history, those motivated by the gospel and those motivated by greed. And the greedy ones are the ones that take land from Indians, sell people into slavery, grow opium in India and ship it into China. And they're involved maybe the marijuana business today. But that those two threads of greed in the gospel cut through every human heart. Every day we have the choice. Are we going to be motivated by greed? Or are we going to be motivated by the gospel? Are we going to be motivated by what is best for others? Or what's going to benefit me? And so we see it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his Gulag Archipelago said, if only we could get all of the bad people and separate them. But he says the problem is it cuts through each human heart. So each one of us are faced with these decisions, the value of human life. So we see this terrible slave trade brought to America. Now, Hinduism has a caste system with five major castes and innumerable smaller castes, and you're born into them. And so the lowest caste is called the Dalits or untouchables. And from the beginning of their history, the untouchables were supposed to take care of the garbage and the sewers. And no matter how good a job they do, they could never graduate and become a Brahmin. The Brahmin are at the top of the Hindu belief system. They're near divinity. So equality did not come, birthed out of India. And matter of fact, when the British took over India, they noticed that they had generational indebtedness. So the rural peasant farming families, they were born into debt. And of course, the saying from the Royal Commission on Agriculture that the British had put together, it says that India's farmer is born in debt, lives in debt, and dies in debt. And so it's this permanent society of debt. And then we see Sharia Islam, where kafir infidels are not equal to believing Muslims, and women are not equal to men. Muhammad said that it takes two women to testify in court against one man because a woman's mind is deficient. And a man can have four wives. A woman can't have four husbands. I don't know which woman would want four husbands, but there's not equality there, right? And all the man has to do to divorce his wife is say, I divorce you three times. The Al-Azhar University recently changed it to say, all you have to do is text your wife three times. I divorce you. And she doesn't even get to go back in and get her clothes. I mean, it's... And so we see the value of human life around the world. It's low. Then socialism and communism. A person's worth is dependent on their utility, their usefulness to the state. If you can contribute to the state, you're worth more. If not, you're voted off the island. They would pull the plug on you. You're not contributing. So I was reading where in 1933, you have Hitler is the head of the National Socialist Workers' Party. That's what Nazi stands for, National Socialistische Arbeiter Party. And they decided to have universal health care. The New York Times ran an article in 1933. It says, the German Penal Code in Germany passed the law that in the interest of true humanity, that physicians would be authorized to end the lives of ill patients. And it said, no life still valuable to the state will be wantonly destroyed. No life still valuable to the state will be wanton. So the state decides your worth. If you contribute to the state, you're worth more. If you don't contribute to the state, you're worth less. And if you're a drain on the state, they pull the plug or prosecute you. And so we see this value of human life. We're all familiar with George Orwell and his Animal Farm, the classic dystopian novel. What's dystopian? That's the opposite of utopian. One of the books I'm writing is on the history of socialism. It all goes back to Plato. And 380 BC, Plato in Greece, and he writes in passing about this city of Atlantis, right, on an island. It's highly structured and very advanced, but they offend the Greek gods and it's sunk in the ocean. And so he refers to this later in his Republic. Plato says that a democracy is great. It's the most charming form of government. It's like a bazaar with embroidery patchwork, and it's like a where you can have everyone has freedom of tolerance and so forth. And then he says that they tolerate people that are a little bit off. And then they tolerate people that are a lot off. To finally, they're tolerating crooks and crime and fraud, and nobody cares. And then he says it creeps into the family, and the sons are disrespectful to the fathers, and if he gets corrected, the son just walks away. And then he says it creeps into the school, and the teachers want to appear like the youth because they don't want to be considered old, and they end up adopting the habits of the youth. And then it says it creeps into their behavior morally. And it says the young man gives into libertinism and useless and unnecessary pleasures, even incest and unnatural union. Yes, that's what Plato's talking about. And it says that then it creeps into their finances and they begin to take the treasury and spread the wealth around until the treasury's empty. And then they say, where can we get more money? They say the rich people, and they take the money from the rich people. Now there's no rich left. And then there's a shortage and they begin to have a bickering and it turns into chaos and anarchy. And then they begin to say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And someone comes along promising to fix it. People yield their freedoms to him. And when he gets challenged, when they cast it in his teeth that he's getting too powerful, he has a choice of giving up power or get rid of the people confronting him. And so he does. He gets rid of the people and he finally stands in the chariot of state holding the reins of power and he's revealed as the tyrant. So Plato explains that democracy without morals and virtue ends in domestic chaos out of which a tyrant arises. Isn't that interesting? And then he says, how's the tyrant going to stay in control? He's going to take the children away from the family before they've been affected by the parents and he'll bring them into the city and indoctrinate them with noble lies. That's what Plato said. He calls them noble lies. And because he's the head of gold and his arms and chest of silver are his administrators and military and the people are the abdomen of bronze and iron. And so you're back to a pyramid structure. And so he said, so this is the basis of socialism, is a structured society of the governing class and the governed class. And so back to the animal farm story, the animals get together and get rid of the farmer. And then they're like, great, no farmer, we're all equal. And then the pigs end up becoming pushy and saying, well, we're smarter and we got to tell everybody what to do. So we deserve more of the apples and more of the food. And then they say, well, isn't everybody equal? And they go, yeah, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. So every time you get a socialist class, there's the governing class, the deep state, and then there's the governed class that have to obey everything. And if you're in the deep state, it's a two-tiered system that you don't get in trouble, that if you get called before the judges or whatever, they let you off the hook. But, well, where did the value of human life come from? The Bible, Judeo-Christian values, where a person's worth and equality is independent of their sex, their race, their class, their usefulness to society. A person's worth and equality is simply because they are made in the image of God. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to give anything to the state. You don't have to be born in a certain, you don't have to be a Muslim male. You don't have to be a Brahmin in the highest caste. It's just by the fact that you are here. You are made in the image of God. So therefore, you have a worth and an identity because God gave it to you. I was writing a book on three secular reasons why America should be under God. And I was talking to an atheist. And they said, I don't want America under God. I said, well, let me ask you a question. Do you like having rights the government cannot take away? Yeah. Then those rights need to come to you from a power higher than the government. That's why the founder said all men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Eisenhower said, in some countries, the state claims to be the author of human rights. If the state gives rights, it can and inevitably will take away those rights. He said, our founding fathers had to refer to the creator in order to make their revolutionary experiment make sense. In other words, we had to go above the king's head. We said, look, king, we're getting rights from God and you're infringing on our God-given rights. Therefore, you're out of here. Right? So instead of a divine right of kings where it's creator, king, people, we go from creator directly to the people. We sort of leave out the king. All men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And so, made in the image of God is a very powerful concept. Calvin Coolidge, the anniversary of the Declaration, says the principles which went into the Declaration of Independence are found in the sermons of the early colonial clergy. They preached equality because they believed in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Did you catch that? Equality because of the fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man. They justified freedom by the text that we are all created in the divine image. You know, when you go back to ancient Israel, Moses said that the judges are supposed to judge irrespective of persons, whether you have two Israelites that are having a problem or if it's an Israelite and a stranger that's amongst them. You read the line and think, oh, it's just what scripture. No, that is very significant, right? Because you look at Sharia law, there's one set of laws for the faithful, believing Muslim male, but a non-Muslim does not have equal rights. The stranger has a different structure, but not so with the Bible, not so with ancient Israel. The stranger that was traveling with the Israelites was under the same law that they were under. And Truman said this in his inaugural, 1949, "We believe that all men are created equal because we're created in the image of God." Well, guess what? If there's no God, who decides who's equal? I guess the government does. Well, what if you get a Hitler in charge of the government? He decides Jews aren't equal, right? Or Stalin that decides the Ukrainians and the kulaks are not equal, right? It's just a power grab. The guy at the top of the pyramid decides if you're benefiting me, you're more equal. If you don't benefit me, you're less equal. Remember Pol Pot in Cambodia who killed a third of his own country? The killing fields, the Khmer Rouge? He said, to keep you is no benefit. To kill you is no loss. It's like your life is only of worth if I think it has worth. And so he killed anybody that had any education, because it's easier to rule ignorant people. He actually killed anybody that wore glasses. And you see the pictures, you can go on the internet. I mean, it's just piles and piles and piles of bones. Why? Because they didn't benefit him. We believe all men are created equal because we're created in the image of God. And if you get rid of God, who decides who's equal? The state does. The state decides the worth of your life. That's why it's important to keep America under God. Now, yes, thank you. Now, in studying history of power, it's basically a spectrum. Like, imagine a line. One side is total government. The other side is no government. Total government, you get a king. He rules through fear. You do what he says or he kills you. No government would be anarchy. No government unless each person is taught the law. It's like everybody downloads a behavioral app on their iPhone. Instead of a GPS telling you where to turn, it tells you how to act in real time, right? Be nice to that person. Don't lose your temper here. Don't steal that. And the Levites in ancient Israel were the computer geeks that help you to download the app. Now, where do I go? Yeah, you go to App Store, you know, Google Play, click here, right? Line upon line, precept upon precept. And so the Levites would help every single Israelite get the law, his own version of the app, right? His own copy. But wait a second. Why would you follow it? What would motivate you to follow an internal moral? Right? You're about to steal. Nobody's around. And you know you can get away with it. And then you think, God is watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable in the future. And that creates something in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country believes that God is there, he's watching everyone, he wants you to be fair, and he's going to hold you accountable in the future, then everybody is practicing self-restraint because you're treating everybody nice because God said, whatever you do to the least of these my brethren, you do unto me. Right? And so we're constantly aware of our accountability to God. Daniel Webster, one of the founding fathers, was an old man, and they asked, what was the most profound thought that ever went through his head? He said, my accountability to God. That's why we're here. We're each aware of our accountability to God, and God wants us to care for the weak among us. Well, thank you. I tell people the greatness of a country is not in its wealth and its military and its economy. The greatness of a country is how well it treats its weakest member. Now, the Old Testament, Leviticus 18, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. All right? That's great. That is a tremendous step up from, oh, you love class-wise, according to this pyramid. And the healthcare practices, interestingly enough, I did a whole study on the history of hospitals. And Moses instructed the Israelites to have a sanitary waste management system, right? You had to go outside of the camp. And he talked about washing with running water. And you compare this to other cultures, even in the Sharia practicing cultures, they don't wash their hands the same way as Western cultures do. And sometimes that gets to be a problem in some of the food processing companies. But Israel here is washing with running water. And if someone has a communicable disease, they were to cover their mouths and keep their distance from others. Imagine that. And then this is interesting. In the Hebrew law, when somebody had a communicable disease, they were isolated for 40 days. Do you know the Jews? There were a number of Jews in Italy. And the number for 40 is pronounced quarantine. So when they say, oh, we got to quarantine somebody. Well, quarantine is the Italian word for 40. Why would you say, oh, there's somebody sick. We got a 40. We got a 40 them. No, that goes back to ancient Israel in the law, where if somebody had a communicable disease, they were isolated for 40 days. And but the New Testament, the value of human life, it elevates the value of human life to the highest level possible. Why? Because you're taught to treat others as you would treat God himself. It's not just, oh, I'm going to treat you the same way I want to be treated. Now it's up, because Jesus says, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. This is a whole different concept for planet Earth. In the 6,000 years of recorded history, where you have pharaohs and Caesars and Kaisers and sultans and czars dominating people's lives and saying, your life is only of worth if it serves me. In other words, those leaders want to be God. And then Jesus comes and says, whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. It's a concept that planet Earth had never, ever seen before. That you treat the lowliest as if you were to treat God himself. Here's Mother Teresa. She said, I see Jesus in every human being. I say to myself, this is hungry Jesus. I must feed him. This one has leprosy or gangrene. I must wash him. I tend to him. I serve because I love Jesus. When you trace the history of hospitals, ancient cultures did have some pseudo-medical care. The Greeks would like get you high on something and then have you sleep with snakes crawling across you. And it's like, okay, that's healthcare. The Egyptians had something with scarabs and from, you know, dung and stuff like that. But when you trace it, back then, healthcare was only for the rich, only for the people on the top of the pyramid. Matter of fact, even in Egypt, only eternal life was only for the Pharaoh. And it was considered an honor to be buried in the tomb with him because that meant you got to go. But it was only for the upper class. There's no other place to trace care for the poor than back to Jesus. Remember the Good Samaritan? Jesus tells a story, but a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, who was beaten and left for dead. And when he took him, he took pity on him. You know, there's something about the soul that cares about others. You know, Jesus says, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Okay, let's analyze this for a second. Gaining the whole world would probably be selfish. You're thinking about what I can get. And so the opposite of that would be selfless, which means you'd be caring for others. There was a news clip recently. It says more and more students are graduating from school in higher percentages of narcissism and less percentages of empathy. What's empathy? That's caring what other people, that's feeling the feelings other people feel, right? And narcissism is, I'm just caring about myself. There's something about having a soul where that means that you care. Remember, you'll tell somebody, oh, that person, he's so mean, he doesn't have a soul. That means he doesn't care about people, which means that having a soul means that you care for people. And here he's talking about the Good Samaritan. It says he took pity on him and he went to him and bound his wounds and poured in the oil and wine and then put him on his donkey and bandaged his wounds and brought him to the inn. and had the innkeeper take care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave it them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." So here, caring for a total stranger, having empathy, and paying money out of your pocket to care for him and take the oil and the wine and pour into his wounds. And then Jesus with the parable of the sheep and the goats. And it says, "Lord, when did we take care of you?" And he said, "I was sick and you visited me." He said, "When?" "Whenever you did it to the least of these." You know, the Syrian church in the East, they pioneered medical care in the East the same way the Catholic Church did in the West. So the Syrian church, they had a school at Nisibis all the way back to the 4th century, sometimes referred to as the world's first university. It was a Christian center of scientific and medical learning located in present-day Turkey. And they would train people to take care of the sick. And then in Rome, you had in the 4th century, St. Jerome, and he helped bring a Christian widow to a genuine faith in the Lord, St. Fabiola. And so she gave her money to build a hospital for the poor in Rome, and she cared for the sick herself. This wasn't taking place in pagan cultures. There wasn't a Pharaoh's daughter that decided to have a hospital for the poor. And around the same time, St. Basil distributed food to the poor of Caesarea, and then he built a poorhouse, a hospice, and a hospital. And the Council of Nicaea, I think it is in 325 AD, directed every city with a cathedral also have an infirmary or a hospital for people traveling on pilgrimages who arrived ill. And so this is interesting. So here it is, 325 AD, people would make pilgrimages to the Holy Land, and after a long, long journey, you'd arrive pretty worn out and maybe even sick. And so you would go to the cathedral, but then that cathedral would have an infirmary to help let you recuperate. And so the word hosp means traveler. And it's the root word for hospital and hospitality and host and hostel and hotel. And so these were travelers going on pilgrimages, and they would be taken care of by the infirmary at the cathedral. And so the word hosp means traveler. So hospital is traveler. But again, it goes back to this Christian concept of going on these pilgrimages. Hospitals were staffed by religious orders. In the 6th century, the Benedictine order had every monastery establish an infirmary. In the 6th century, a physician named St. Sampson the Hospitable turned his home in Constantinople into a free medical clinic for the poor. And he was so, his reputation spread that when the Byzantine Emperor Justinian became ill, he sent for St. Sampson. And after recovering, the emperor offered a reward to Sampson, but instead of a reward, he requested help for establishing a new hospital for the poor, which continued in Constantinople for 600 years. Again, why is he doing this? Because Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. Visit the sick. Be like the Good Samaritan. This is the Christian message impacting culture. It didn't come from Hinduism or Buddhism or whatever. When Islamic warriors invaded into Christian Syria in 634 AD, and Byzantine Christian Jerusalem hospitals needed now to be defended. And so there would be a group of knights hospitaller. They were like security guards for the hospital, right? And they would help protect people who are going on pilgrimage. Now that it's getting more dangerous to go on a pilgrimage. And then the Benedictine monastery in Salerno, Italy, founded the oldest and most famous medical school university in Western Europe. It's a Benedictine order. It's a Catholic order that started medical care. And now, matter of fact, most universities were started as in monasteries and cathedrals. So this was the Christian contribution to education and learning. So it was the Catholic Cities at this time in Bologna, Paris, Naples, Toulouse, Oxford started universities, and amongst them would teach medical care. Charlemagne, who was crowned in the year 800 AD in Rome, was the Holy Roman Emperor. His grandfather was Charles Martel that stopped the Muslims who were invading France at the Battle of Tours. But Charlemagne decreed that hospitals, which had fallen into disrepair, should be restored. 1300s, bubonic plague or Black Death ravaged Europe, killing 75 million people. Crops were left standing in the field. There was no one to harvest them. The Pope gave a general absolution to everybody because nobody could do anything. And with often no one to bury the dead, an order of Catholic men called Election Brothers began to collect the bodies and give them a Christian burial. And if the people weren't dead yet, they acted as a hospice, that they would take care of them. And it was a concept that went into Catholic medical care, that you're preparing the person's soul to meet God, right? So you're caring to them for a spiritual purpose. They also provided hospice care to those that were banished from the cities. So if you got this bubonic plague, everybody's going to kick you out of the city. Where are you? Well, you're sort of out there. Well, no, you're sick. You need somebody to care for you. So the Election Brothers would start caring for them. Now, one of the oldest hospitals in Europe was Hotel Dieu, or the Hostel of God. The hostel meant that place for the travelers to be. And it was founded in Paris in the year 660 AD. We're tracing the history of healthcare. And so these were Catholic orders that founded this famous hotel. By 1217, the Hotel Dieu was staffed by Catholic sisters following the rule of St. Augustine. And you know what? They did it for free because they were doing it unto God. As we've de-Christianized our medical care, the prices have gone up, right? And in 1633, the Sisters of Charity began helping at the Hotel Dieu in Paris. And then the Sisters of Charity established hospitals all throughout France for the poor. And then, as I mentioned, there's other religious orders were formed, like the Trinitarians, and they would collect alms and ransom people back from Muslim slavery. And do you know one of the people they ransomed back from Muslim slavery? Was St. Vincent de Paul, right? He had been captured by the Muslims and enslaved. And the account is that after several years, he was witnessing to one of his master's wives, and she became a Christian, and then the master became a Christian, and then arranged for Vincent de Paul to escape. He went back to Europe, and he started to care for the poor. And so in 1607 is when he escaped back. So about the same year that Jamestown is being founded, you have St. Vincent de Paul coming back to Europe. Now, in this era, the wealthy had doctors visit them at their homes, but the poor were primarily cared for at these Catholic hospitals. By 1789, there were 6,000 Sisters of Charity running 426 hospitals all across France. And they also ran hospitals across Europe in Poland, Austria, Switzerland, Italy, Spain, and Cilicia. Now, they were a Catholic order of nuns. And what verse inspired them? Well, one from Timothy. In the New Testament, we're talking about tracing the history of caring for the poor. And it was, a widow be taken into the number, well reported for good works, if she have lodged strangers, if she have washed the feet of saints, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work. And so these were women that cared for the poor. And now during the secular French Revolution, they had a reign of terror. These secular mobs stormed into the mother house of the Sisters of Charity. They demanded that the nuns deny their faith and submit to this new atheistic government. And they didn't. And they were taken to the guillotines. And the stories are that they would be singing their hymns. One by one, they'd get their heads chopped off. None of them would deny their faith, and then the last one did. French secular government So they were called the Martyrs of Compiègne. They sang their hymn one by one, and they were all beheaded July 17th, 1794. Well, the Sisters of Charity survived as an order, and in the 19th century, the nuns spread health care to the poor around the world. Portugal, Hungary, England, Scotland, Ireland, North and South America, Turkey, Syria, Egypt, Persia, Abyssinia, China, Jerusalem. And Geoffrey Blainey wrote in A Short History of Christianity, says, the Catholic Church conducted hospitals for the old and orphanages for the young, hospices for the sick of all ages, places for lepers, and hostels or inns where pilgrims could buy a cheap bed and meal. It supplied food to the population during famine and distributed food to the poor. And now, more Catholic orders were formed to care for the sick and nurse, and change bedpans and start leper colonies, such as the Daughters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul, founded 1633, Sisters of St. Joseph, founded 1650, Sisters of Mercy, 1827, Little Sisters of the Poor, 1839, Sisters of Providence, 1843, Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine, 1851, and Sisters of St. Mary, 1872, Sisters of the Little Company of Mary, 1877, Sisters of the Sorrowful Mother, 1883, and Father Damon, here he is in Hawaii, taking care of the lepers. And nobody wanted to take care of the lepers. They just put him on this one island of Molokai and just left them to die. Well, what did he do? He went to that island and he ministered to the lepers. And then he eventually died of leprosy. He made such an impact on Hawaii that they have a statue of him at Hawaii's state capitol. And every state gets to put two statues in the U.S. capitol. And guess what? One of Hawaii's statues is that of Father Damien. He was motivated by the gospel to take care of the poor. Now, during the Civil War, in the era when most women had family obligations and could only volunteer temporarily as battlefield nurses, the sisters were trained in nursing and served sacrificially their entire lives. So you have in Florence Nightingale, fighting with the British, fighting the Russians in the Crimean War. And so she's the lady with the lamp, and she's going around at nighttime, you know, checking on the patients. And she says, what training is there to compare with that of a Catholic nun? She's like, they're the ones that know how to do health care. Matter of fact, it was the nun's habit, their hat, that was adopted by the nurses. So the distinctive nurse hat came from the nun's hat. The history of healthcare, the history of the value of human life.
You've been listening to William J. Federer, a nationally known speaker, best-selling author, and president of Amerisearch, and presenter at the 2020 Bringing America Back to Life convention.
From the Median is listener-supported. Visit our website, fromthemedian.org, for further information or to make a donation to continue to make this radio program possible. Email us, radionews@fromthemedian.org, or call 440-668-4049. Through our fromthemedian.org website, you can download this or previous programs for your listening pleasure, or sign up to receive our weekly preview of upcoming guest interviews. Tune in every weeknight at the same time to listen to another great interview on From the Median as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. From the Median is brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.